Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 75. I'm recording it on Tuesday, January 13th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is They're Using Our Natural Risk Aversion Against Us. I read articles on investing each morning, go around the internet, make the rounds. I saw an article today, I don't recall where it was, but one point made in it stuck with me, that the person who wrote the article pointed out that there's a lot of behavioral finance research that shows that humans are naturally risk averse. We don't like risk. There are a lot of these studies that show that if you give people two options, one where they're likely to hold on to their money, and the other where there's a small chance that they would lose a good bit of money, but a much larger chance that they would make even more money. In other words, in probability terms, this is a good option that they're being presented with, because the upside is greater than the downside potential. People will choose the safer option. As a rule, we are risk averse to our own detriment. And the question then that this person asked in the article was, given that we are risk averse, how did it ever happen that stocks became so insanely overvalued, and we got ourselves into this terrible crisis we're facing today, where when stocks returned to normal valuation levels, we suffered a economic crisis as a result of the astounding losses in our portfolio values? How is it that a risk-averse people ended up taking on risk far beyond what they ever should have considered taking on? And the purpose of this podcast is to examine that question a bit. And a starting point is to just try to define what risk means. I've argued in other podcasts that our understanding of how stock investing works today is primitive. And this is another example of how that is so. Stock investing is all about risk. If you don't understand risk, if you don't understand the risk of stocks, you don't understand stocks. And almost very few of us understand how the risk of stock investing works. I don't mean to put myself forward as some sort of special genius. I certainly did not understand risk, you know, some time back. And I've been studying it during the first 7 years of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, and I think I have a much better handle on it today, but I certainly don't say that I understand stock risk entirely. To the extent I understand it at all, I understand it because of the discussions we've had in the retire early and indexing communities over the past 7 years. But there are two primary theories of what's entailed in stock risk, and then I'll offer a third, which I think is closer to the mark. The first theory, the dominant theory, is the theory associated with the passive investing model, which essentially says that risk is volatility. This theory is that the reason why stocks provide higher returns than other asset classes is that stocks are riskier. And what that means, when they say stocks are riskier, what they mean is stocks are more volatile than other asset classes. The price goes up and down a lot. And that's why we call stocks risky. Now, Warren Buffett has criticized this approach to risk, I think, very effectively. Warren Buffett pointed out in something I read, and I think he's done this in other places, that if he were to buy a stock at a $20 price, he were to buy two stocks, both at a $20 price, and one were to stay at $20, and he experienced no gains whatsoever for 10 years, and the other stock went from $20 to $80, he experienced huge gains. If you define risk as being volatility, the second stock is the risky one. The first stock has no risk attached to it. But this is crazy. How can you say that an asset that's giving you no gain for 10 years is risky? Is not risky, lacks risk entirely, and yet one that is giving you huge gains and always going up, never going down, is a high-risk asset. That's crazy. And the point, of course, that Buffett is getting at is it's not volatility that is risk. It's losing money that is risk. It's volatility is not necessarily bad. Upward volatility is wonderful. What's risky is the idea that you might lose money. So Buffett has a different understanding of risk than the passive investors, and I think Buffett's understanding is closer to the mark, but there is a sense in which volatility is an issue because. And I think the reason why the passive investing advocates lean towards defining risk as volatility is that a big thing in passive investing is the idea that stocks do better over the long term. They become a better investment class when held for the long term. And you could say that if you hold stocks, say, for 30 years, stocks offer the odds that stocks are going to give a good return are very high indeed. Very, very high indeed. And if that's the case, then you could say stocks are a low risk, and you were using Buffett's definition, you could say that stocks are a low risk asset class because you're almost sure to get big gains. The risk of losing money is very small 30 years out. And the passive investors don't want to say that because they believe that the reason why stocks provide high returns is that you're being compensated for taking on additional risk. So they don't like the idea of saying that stocks are not a risky asset class. So they define risk as being volatility to try to square these different realities. So they say, yes, maybe you don't have to really worry about what's going to happen in 30 years. There's not really risk in the long term, but there's a lot of volatility. There's a lot of upward and downward motion. And so if we define volatility as risk, we can say, yes, stocks are risk. And then we've explained why stock returns are as high as they are. All of these people are really, they're starting with their, how can I describe it? They're starting with their theory. They know what they want to say. They know what they want to believe. And they're sort of squeezing the definition of risk to fit that theory. And I think Buffett's definition of risk is a better one. But I do think there's something to the idea that risk is volatility. I think it's sort of a combination. And the way I think about risk is that, yes, obviously the biggest fear, the biggest risk is the idea that you could lose money. That gets closer to the mark. But we are affected by volatility. And I think what we really need to study to come to a better understanding of what constitutes risk is, we can't just go with this 30-year definition. We can't just say, well, stocks are good at the end of 30 years. What really matters is, how do stocks do at different time periods? You can't just go 30 years out. You have to say, well, how, you know, when the passive investors ask people whether they're capable of handling risk, they say, well, what sort of price drop can you handle? Of course, you know, can you afford, would you be able to handle a 20% loss of your money, or 30% or 40% or 50%? What can you handle? And people who say, I can handle 50%, they say, well, you're more open to risk than somebody that says they can only handle 10% or 20%. But the right way to think about it is to say, how much of a loss can you handle at different time periods? Because there are some people who can handle, say, a 50% loss for 1 year. But if that 50% loss remains in place for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, they will give up and they will sell. So it's not, risk is not just having the stock price drop. That's not all that risk is. Risk has more than one dimension. It's partly seeing the price of your portfolio, the value of your portfolio drop, and it's partly how long that drop remains in place. Because we need money at different times in our lives. We don't need money only, I see this all the time at discussion boards where passive investing advocates congregate. They will say, I'm investing this money for my retirement and I'm 30, so I'm not going to retire till I'm 60. So I don't need the money for 30 years. So it doesn't matter to me. Not worried about price drops. Doesn't matter. And I think these people are fooling themselves. And the quote-unquote experts are encouraging them to fool themselves. That's the point of this podcast. No one, I don't believe there's anyone who looks only 30 years out. We all care about what happens 30 years out, to be sure. We all also care about what happens 5 years out and 10 years out, 15 and 20. And unless we start thinking about risk as a multidimensional thing, we will never come to grasp what stock risk is all about. So I think we need to look at it in a slightly more sophisticated way than we've looked at it before. Risk is not as simple as we've been told it is. And this is the explanation for the paradox raised in the article I read this morning. I think it's true that humans are by nature risk averse. I do think that's true. And what the behavioral finance people mean when they say that is that we are too disinclined to take on risk. We should be willing to take on more risk. We all would lead more fulfilled lives if we took on more risk, not less risk. And this is one of the things that, of course, is a pet peeve of mine. When I talk about stock investing at discussion boards, people often, and I of course always make the point that stocks are far, far, far more risky at times of high valuations than they are at times of moderate valuations. And people will say, oh, Rob, you're scared. You're scared, aren't you, Rob? You don't want to take on stocks. You're scaredy cat. That's what it is. They say, that's okay, Rob. You don't have to invest in stocks. We understand you're scaredy cat. It has nothing to do with being a scaredy cat. If anything, I think I take on more risk than many of these people do who claim that they're willing to take on risk. I am not in favor of taking on, you know, insane levels of risk, but I am very much in favor of taking calculated risks. And what the behavioral finance people are pointing out when they say we're risk averse is that most of us are inclined, because of our human nature, to take on not as much risk as we should. We should be striving to take a little more risk than most of us do. In the stock area, unfortunately, what's happened is the way passive investing has been sold to us, the people who marketed it, and I don't say that this was intentional. I believe that it was partly intentional, but not fully. I'd say more unintentional than intentional. But the people trying to market passive investing did was they took advantage of our risk-averse nature to encourage us to take on more risk than we should have taken on. Now, that's all mixed up and backwards and crazy, but I do think that's what's happened. It's a very, very sad story. And I think it's something we need to come to terms with as we move out of the passive investing era into the rational investing era, into an era when we will invest in more sane and sensible and reasonable ways. Now, something I want to mention as a final point of preface on this particular podcast is I refer to the investing model that I recommend at the site as rational, the rational investing model. And I contrast that with the passive investing model. Passive investing is the model that says you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to big price changes. And the rational model says you must change your stock allocation in response to big price changes. So they're opposite models. And the implications of that change are very far-reaching. So the rational investor and the passive investor do different things on almost every question solely because of this difference, that passive investors aim not to change their stock allocations. Rational investors aim to change their stock allocations. Not often. Many rational investors might change their stock allocation once every 10 years. So they don't change them often, but they do change them. When the price level changes dramatically, the rational investor will always change his stock allocation. He would not dream of staying at the same stock allocation when prices are insanely dangerous that he was at as he was at when prices were reasonable or low. I call this model the rational investing model. I considered calling it probability investing. Instead of calling it rational investing, calling it probability investing. And there are times, today I'm feeling it because I'm preparing this podcast, there are times when I think probability investing would be a better name for the model. Probability investing describes what the rational investing model is all about very well. The idea is, instead of, you know, passive investing is sort of shooting in the dark. It's sort of, you know, just take a chance. Hope that somehow this will be the first time in history that valuations won't make a big difference on long-term returns. Hope that everything will turn out different than it's ever turned out before. That's purely an emotional approach. And the reason I went with the rational investing name for the model is that I wanted to contrast it with the emotional model. I think of passive investing as a totally emotional model. And so rational investing was in contrast to emotion is, of course, reason. So rational investing is the name I came up with. But once you get over the hurdle of accepting that rational is the way to go, once you abandon passive investing, a more descriptive title for this approach is probability investing. Once you agree that the thing to do is to use your human reason to decide on your stock allocation, not to just blindly stick with one stock allocation, which I believe is insane. I don't believe the people who do it are insane. Millions do it, and millions of very smart people do it. But I do believe it's insane. I think we will look back, I don't know how many years in the future, 20, 30 years in the future, and we will look back at how people invested during the passive investing era, and we will view them as having been insane. We won't be able to understand it. Just like we look back at people now who thought the earth was flat or thought that the sun revolved around the earth. And we say, you know, those people were crazy. I think that's how people are going to look back at passive investors someday. It's a truly crazy idea. The idea that you can stick with the same stock allocation regardless of the price at which stocks, you know, sell for. That's why it's so hard to combat the idea, because it's so fundamental, it's so basic, and the flaws are so obvious that it's very hard for people to accept that they've fallen for such an idea. So that's why cognitive dissonance kicks in, and people have a hard time thinking about this logically. But once you make the transition to the rational model, you know, there are sort of two hurdles you have to get over. The first hurdle is giving up passive investing. And that's where I spend most of my energies, persuading people to give up passive investing. But once you do that, then the hurdle is, how do I invest most effectively? You know, it changes from a negative thing to a positive thing. Instead of trying to overcome your emotional inclination to be a passive investor, you're You're trying to pursue your rational desire to be an effective investor. And that's all about determining probabilities. So all of your future efforts are aimed at looking at probabilities. And that's a stock investing is a game of probabilities. It's all about no one knows the future, but the future can be assessed. Different possibilities can be assessed, and we can assign probabilities to them. And we can say, well, you know, in these sorts of circumstances, an 80% stock allocation makes all the sense in the world. In this other set of circumstances, 20% makes all the sense in the world. And in a third set of circumstances, 50% makes all the sense in the world. And so there is, you know, there is no one allocation that you can attach to everybody. And that's sort of what the passive investor says, oh, what's my one allocation? I'm just going to stick with that through all circumstances. And there is none. There never can be one. That's why I say it's insane. When you choose passive investing, you're rejecting consideration of the most important question. Your very first step is to say, I will ignore what stock investing is all about. I don't know what the right thing or the wrong thing is. I'm sure that I'll do the wrong thing because I'll devote no thought to the question whatsoever. Rational investing is all about devoting thought to it and trying to come up with the best possible answer. So it could be that in time I will switch that name to probability investing. I am tempted to do that from time to time. I've never really been confident as to whether rational investing or probability investing was the better choice of a name. Now, what the argument of this podcast is that they're using our natural risk aversion against us. We are risk averse. We don't like risk. And so the last thing in the world that most middle-class investors would want to do is to invest too heavily in stocks. So how is it that we got to a point where a lot of us were going with, you know, if you look at the historical data for, you know, what made sense as a good stock allocation, say from 1995 through the first part of 2008, what the data says is that for those years, the best stock allocation from 1995, the valuation levels we were at from 1995 through the first part of 2008 is 0%. Stocks were insanely dangerous for that entire time period. So if you went strictly by the numbers, you would argue for a zero stock allocation. I don't argue that. I personally was at a zero stock allocation, but that's because of my particular life circumstances. My usual recommendation is that most investors should have been at something between 20 and 30%. Obviously, there is no one allocation that applies for everybody. But I believe people should always maintain some stock allocation on... Not because the numbers indicate it. There are some valuation levels that are just so high that a zero stock allocation makes logical sense. I think it's a good idea to keep something in stocks because there's always that remote possibility that even during times of insane prices, there will be price jumps and you may regret it if you have a zero stock allocation. So by keeping 20% of your money in stocks, you're going to get hurt in a price crash a little bit. You know, a 50% price crash would mean a 10% loss of portfolio value, but I feel that you can take that sort of hit. And of course, if stocks go up, then you'll be participating. And we did see that happen from 96, 97, 98, 99, stocks went up, even though they were insanely priced in 1996. They continued to go up. So you can't rule out price increases. Even when we're at insanely high prices, you can't rule out further price increases. So I tend to think, even at those times, small stock allocations make sense. But many, many middle-class investors were at allocations much higher than 20% from 1995 through the first part of 2008. I don't know what the average stock allocation is, and it's all over the map, I'm sure, but... I know one guy, John Graney. He has a study at the retireearlyhomepage.com site, and John says, you know, he calculates the optimal, what he calls the optimal stock allocation, and he says the optimal stock allocation is 74%, and lots of people agree with him. He's certainly not alone in that. And I've participated in many discussion boards, and I've you know, I've seen people that have 100% stock allocation. I've seen people with 80. I think it's more common to see something like 60. I think that's more common. But 60 is certainly not considered weird or strange or insanely dangerous by most people. Even at the valuation levels that applied from 95 through the first part of 2008, many people might have 50%. So 50, 60, 70, 80% stock allocations are not considered outlier possibilities. They're considered normal. They're considered, you know, reasonable. Even though the historical data shows that those stock allocations are wildly dangerous at the price levels we've been at. Until today, we're no longer at those price levels. Today, those stock allocations are reasonable. Today, it's true. But it was not true before the price crash. In an objective sense, it was not true. So how did it come to be? We're naturally risk averse. We're naturally risk averse. And yet, most of us were going with stock allocations three times what the historical data indicates was appropriate. Three times, even four times, what the data shows to be appropriate. How'd that happen? There were a lot of things going on during the passive investing era. And again, I just want to make the point. I don't think these things were. They were sort of quasi-intentional. They weren't intentionally. I don't think there are bad people who, you know, developed a conspiracy against us. I don't. When I say there's a little hint of that in the title, when I say they're using our natural risk aversion against us, there's sort of a suggestion there of some sort of conspiracy. And I don't really mean to suggest that, but I mean to suggest that the quote-unquote experts have encouraged us to do the opposite of what we should have been doing, and the opposite of what our natural inclinations told us to do. But I don't think they did it with bad intent. I think they did it because, you know, they have pressures on them, for one thing, to sell stocks. And so they try to do that. And a lot of the experts really were taken in by the research. And there was research supporting these passive investing ideas in the 60s and 70s, and even after that, although the research going the other way began in the 1980s. But to this day, there's academic research that comes out that supports the passive investing model. To this day, that's true. And a lot of the experts are taken in by that. They love being able to cite research because it sort of lets them off the hook. I think anyone who's in the stock advice business is nervous about giving recommendations. And when you can point to academic research to justify your recommendations, you feel a lot better. I'll discuss that aspect of the question in another podcast. But I just want to say up front that I don't mean to suggest that this was intentional. But it was intentional in the sense that they did want to encourage us to invest more heavily in stocks. You see, the intent was there to achieve the result. The experts know that we're risk adverse. They know this. And they think we should be less so. And they've tried to overcome our risk aversion. So in that sense, it's intentional. But it's not intentional that they were trying to hurt us. They thought they were helping us, but they weren't. They were hurting us, and they believe themselves. They most of them, I believe, invest this way themselves. Most of the experts are overinvested in stock, or were overinvested in stocks from 1995 through the first part of 2008. So how is it that they were able to use our natural risk aversion against us? Well, one thing is they taught us that stocks are always best for the long run. And of course, there's a famous book by that title, Stocks for the Long Run. And that message is, it's sort of a half-truth. There's a very important truth at the root of that. I call it a marketing slogan, Stocks for the Long Run. But there's a great truth there that if you hold stocks for the long run, the risk of stocks, it does diminish. If you're a long-term investor, the risk of stocks really does diminish, I believe. So there's a powerful insight there that if you become a long-term investor, you find a way to tap into the long-term returns of stocks and yet to avoid much of the risk because the volatility diminishes over time. And you can see this in the stock return predictor. Look at look at the range of possible returns at 10 years and then look at what it is at 30 years, and you'll see it diminishes greatly. So knowing your return, that's the secret. That's the secret to successful stock investing. When you have a good grasp of what sort of return you're going to obtain at what particular time period, you will no longer be nervous. Your nervousness will, your anxiety will diminish. And you're far better able to do that the farther out you go. So stocks for the long run contains an important truth. What's lacking in the stocks for the long run concept is consideration of the valuation effect, because valuations cause stocks to give different returns, different long-term returns. So what happens with the long term is that stock returns become more predictable. But if you're purchasing the stocks at times of good prices, they become more predictably good in the long term. If you're purchasing stocks at times of poor prices, they become predictably poor the long-term return. So it's not really so that investing for the long term is always good. If you invest, if you go out 30 years, it is. But if you go out 10 years, which to most of us, that's what the word long-term means. If you go out 10 years, stocks purchased at high prices are predictably poor. They provide a predictably poor return. So the risk is greater. In other words, if you bought stocks in January of 2000, you had a chance, you had a good chance that in the next month you would get a good return. Because all through the late 90s, stocks were insanely overpriced and provided good returns in most months. So the short-term investor, his risk wasn't really all that great. But the long-term investor, his risk was huge. The odds that you were going to get a good 10-year return for stocks purchased in January 2000 were minuscule. It was almost certain you were going to lose money in the long term. So the risk actually grows when stocks are poorly priced instead of diminishes for the long-term investor. So they use this concept of long-term investing, and boy, this is the long-term investing concept ever. You see, we are risk adverse by nature. So something I really don't like is when people say that the two emotions they ascribe to stock investors is fear and greed. Fear, I think, is very, very, very real. I see fear everywhere among investors. I see a lot of fear, mainly because I think people don't understand the realities. If people understood how stock investing works, the fear would diminish and people would become less risk averse. It would be a very good thing. But today, most people don't understand how stock investing works, and that makes them fearful. They try to cover it up with bravado. Passive investing dogmatists show a lot of bravado, but they're very fearful underneath. You know, scratch the surface and you see fear. But the greed, I don't see so much. I don't say it doesn't exist, but I don't see it that much. And what most middle-class investors are looking for is they are risk averse, just as the behavioral finance research indicates. What they're looking for is they want to invest in stocks. They're looking for a safe way to invest in stocks. And the stocks for the long run concept, boy, it fits the bill. It sounds so prudent. It, you know, the idea, because, oh, it's like, you know, they used to say this about Listerine, you know, Listerine mouthwash. You know, I don't know if this is true or not. It might be an urban myth, but I remember reading this that, you know, Listerine tasted awful, just awful. And the other mouthwashes tasted, you know, not bad. And there were people that wrote this, but I've never checked it out. I don't know. There were people who said that Listerine, the company, deliberately made it taste awful, and then they would advertise, "It tastes so awful, you know, it must be doing you good." You know, we would never make it taste so awful. In other words, this is human psychology. Make something really bad and you get people to believe it must be doing something good for them. You know, it's like Smuckers, you know. With a name like Smuckers, you know it's good. So tell people that they've got to invest for the long term, and they're, you know, you're imposing a little penalty on them. You're saying you've got to lock your money up for 10 years. You know, you're not going to be one of these short-term flim-flam investors. You're locking your money up for 10 years. Well, tell them that, and people are going to believe, hey, I bet that that reduces my risk. That makes sense. To a prudent, responsible person, that concept makes a lot of sense. It's wrong. Completely wrong. It's not completely, I don't want to say completely wrong, but it's completely wrong at times of high prices. Times of high prices, the 10-year risk is sky high. You know, you might get away with investing it at times of high prices for a year or 6 months or a year, maybe 2 years if you're really lucky. But 10 years? No way, Jose. Ain't going to happen. You're going to suffer a bone-crushing price crash if you invest at times of insane prices and hold for 10 years. So it's the opposite. But they used our risk aversion. We don't like risk. And so we're drawn to the stocks for the long run concept. We love it. And we believe it. We're willing to stake our retirement. A lot of middle class investors never would have been willing to put their money in stocks at those prices had they relied on their common sense. But they heard about this stocks for the long run concept and they said, yeah, well, that makes sense. That makes sense. They didn't do it because they were greedy. They weren't overreaching. The appeal was to their risk aversion. It was to the same thing that makes them averse to risk. Their desire to be responsible and safe and not lose money. Now, they combined that with another very powerful, powerful argument. The idea that the real risk is not investing in stocks. The real risk is not investing in stocks. How many times have you heard that? That was the killer. Combined with the long-term concept, but that was the real killer. The idea that, you know, there are a lot of risk-averse people, and you know, because that's the way we are. Middle-class people are risk-averse. And so a lot of people, the last thing they wanted to do was to overinvest in stocks. But what did they hear on television, on radio, magazines? They heard that people who don't invest in stocks are not responsible. They're irresponsible. You've got to invest in stocks. Inflation is eating your money alive. And if you don't invest heavily in stocks, you're not going to have the money for retirement. So they flipped everything. They took risk aversion made us reluctant to invest heavily in stocks, and they flipped it. They said, oh, it's the irresponsible people who don't invest in overpriced stocks. You've got to invest in overpriced stocks. Again, I don't think intentionally. I hate to think it would be intentional. That would be truly, I don't know if I could wake up tomorrow if I thought that they were all doing it intentionally. I think they fooled themselves first, and then they fooled us. But, of course, the practical effect was the same. They put us in circumstances where we engaged in massive overinvestment in stocks, and we paid a very big financial penalty. And they were using our risk, our natural risk aversion against us. Now, of course, another way they used our risk aversion against us, a third way, is that they dressed all this up in science. And I've explored the science question in an earlier podcast. I don't recall the exact title, but I think I called it something like stock investing is science when it's not science fiction, something like that. And, again, we are risk averse. We don't want to be involved in flighty investment choices. Not with our retirement money. You know, we go to Las Vegas on vacation, maybe. Or we go to Atlantic City. So we don't mind gambling. I don't think the middle class person objects to gambling. But most of us limit the amount that we will gamble. We will not gamble with our retirement money. Retirement money, that's safe money. We're risk averse. Just as the behavioral finance people say. But they came to us with this stocks for the long run stuff, this it's irresponsible not to be heavily invested in stock stuff. And with the idea that these ideas are science. Science isn't risky, you see. This was the killer. This was how they won us over. They said, We're talking science. All those people telling you, oh, stocks are too dangerous when they're overpriced. Well, those people, they're just scaredy cats. They're giving into their emotions. This is science. Science. Science isn't risky. Science is the real thing. Science is numbers. Science is hard. This is what, you know, I dealt with at the Motley Fool Board. I used to argue, you know, against John Graney, his old school safe withdrawal rate study. And I'd say, you know, the numbers are all wrong. It's a problem. He's got to fix the numbers. And, or actually before that, before we got into that, there are people who would come to the board and, you know, John was just, he was insane with the stuff he would say about stocks. You know, put all your money in stocks. Like I say, 74% is optimal. He didn't say it was reasonable. He didn't say he personally liked it. He said it was scientifically shown to be optimal, the best allocation. It was the best, except for just about all the others. But people would, you know, people, it wasn't just me. There were lots of people who would try to put forward a common sense viewpoint, and they would be shot down because he'd say, well, I've got science. You don't have science. You're just a scaredy cat. I have science. Now, he was sort of a cartoon version of this argument. But there are lots of people out there who were making similar claims. If, you know, if you look at John Bogle's work, and much of John Bogle's work is wonderful, as I always say, but some of it is not so wonderful. Some of it advocates passive investing. And you know, he uses science. He's got tables. He's got numbers. That's science. He talks about academic studies. And there are academic studies that support passive investing. So they use science. And science is an appeal to that part of us, inside us, that wants safety. It's not, they weren't saying, hey, you know, Bogle doesn't say, hey, you can double your money overnight. Never, 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 never has he said something like that. It's the opposite of what Bogle's all about. Never does he make things that are get rich quick schemes on the surface. I think they are. Passive investing, I say, is the biggest get rich quick scheme there ever was. But it doesn't appear to be. Its marketing appeal is not that it's a get-rich-quick scheme. It doesn't promise riches overnight. It says that it's based on science. And that causes our risk aversion to sort of go to sleep. It, you know, we say, well, okay, these are the safe people. These passive investing people, they're the good guys. They're the people that speak our language. They're risk-averse. I like that. And then we buy into it, and what we're really buying into is passive investing, which is, I think, the most dangerous approach of all because it ignores valuations. Whereas if you didn't go along with the so-called science, you'd be thinking, wait a minute, this is very dangerous. And then when prices started to drop, you would get out. You'd protect yourself. But not the passive investor. The passive investor says, oh, I got science on my side. I'll keep, you know, staying there. And then one day you look up and 50% of your retirement money's gone. So they enticed us with science. And a fourth way in which they used our natural risk aversion against us is they did all this at a time of great middle class insecurity. We are risk averse. We don't like the idea of investing heavily in stocks, especially at times of high prices. But that's not our only fear, you know. That's one fear. We've got others. A big fear that the middle class has had in recent decades is the fear of falling behind, the fear of losing our middle class status, the fear that jobs are going overseas, the fear that our economy is becoming a sort of a winner-take-all economy, winners and losers, and there's no room left for the middle class. Fear that our jobs are going to become obsolete, fear that employers don't stick with us. You know, you work your way up. It used to be you could work your way up and you were sure that your employer was going to take care of you, you know, unless you did something absolutely terrible. You know, you showed up drunk or something. But today, people don't feel that way. They feel, oh, you know, there's a change in the economy and I'm out on the street and I can't get a job my age. So they mix this stew together at a time of great middle class insecurity. And so what we were thinking, what a lot of middle-class people were thinking is not, hey, stocks are too dangerous. We were thinking not being in stocks is too dangerous. You know, we're all worried we're not saving enough for retirement. So the fear was not being in stocks. They flipped it. Instead of our risk aversion keeping us out of stocks at times of high prices, they put us into stocks. You know, another thing they did is that they neutralized our ability to think all this through carefully by failing to define terms. And I could go on the failure to define terms for a long time, but I'll just pick the most egregious example. The most important example of defining terms is, what does it mean to invest for the long term? I mentioned that investing for the long term is a very powerful concept. There's a lot of truth to it. But there's truth to it when you invest for 30 years. At 30 years out, all of the things that the passive investing advocates tell you is true. More or less. You know, may not be perfectly true, but it's true enough. It's true enough. It's the real thing. It works at 30 years. Most of us think of the long term as 5 years or 10 years. And at 5 years or 10 years, it doesn't work at all. It's the opposite of what works. But they never say that. Very rarely do people advocating long-term investing spell out what it means. Does it mean you have to stick with this for 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, what? If you don't spell that out, I mean 10 years. When I use the word long-term and I don't specify a time period, I'm usually referring to a 10-year time period. I do advocate long-term investing, but I don't give you numbers that work 30 years out. I give you numbers that work 10 years out, because I think those are the numbers that have practical significance for in the real world, for real world investors. You know, the message that's coming out now, you know, a lot of the passive investing advocates are getting scared that their approach is not working. And, you know, there's a thread, I've mentioned it before, Taylor Larimore, the co-author of the Bogleheads Guide to Investing, he had a thread at bogleheads.org where he talked about he has a plan B that he never told us about before. And plan B is he's going to sell all of his stocks. If prices continue to go down, go to zero stock allocation. Now, one of the things that he said on that thread, and he wasn't the only one, there were others agreeing with him. They were saying, these are passive investing advocates. They were saying, you shouldn't put any money into, and they were quoting Bogle. They were saying you shouldn't put any money into stocks that you can't afford to lose. This is the new passive investing wisdom. This is the plan B advice that we hadn't been told about until after the price crash. But the new line is, you don't put any money into stocks that you can't afford to lose. Now, I think that is a flat out insane approach to risk evaluation. Most of us can't afford to lose the money we're putting into stocks. We're putting money into stocks to finance our retirements. And most of us are worried that we haven't put enough aside. So we can't afford losses. Now, what we want to be doing, if people are risk averse, and they are, and we tell them, don't put in any money you can't afford to lose, they're not going to put any money into stocks. And this is where I fear we are going today. The way passive investing is changing today, it's going to be, instead of getting us over-invested in stocks at times of high prices, it's going to be a philosophy that causes us to under-invest in stocks at times of low prices. Passive investing gets us at both ends. It appeals to our most negative emotions at both ends of the emotional spectrum. I don't at all agree with this idea that you should only invest money you can afford to lose. I think you have to take this stocks for the long term concept and use it in realistic ways. The realistic way to use it is to say, I will invest money that I can't afford to lose in stocks because I know that if I suffer a big loss, it will come back. But then obviously you need to only go with an allocation where that's true. At times of insanely high prices, like we had from 95 through 2008, you had no reason to think the money was ever going to come back. Stocks were so wildly overpriced that a 50% price loss was nothing. That money's not coming back. But that's not true today. Today, if you suffer a 50% price loss, and you could for money you put in stocks today, the odds are very strong you're going to get that money back within 10 years. So today, I think you can afford to invest money in stocks that you can't afford to lose. But that was not true 16 months ago. And unfortunately, the passive investors are now reporting this truth at exactly the worst time. They're putting it forward. It addresses our risk, our ability to take on risk. And they're giving exactly the wrong message at exactly the wrong time. Now, what we let me give some optimistic news. I feel like some of this is, I always worry that when I, stock investing is a downer for people, and people avoid downers, and if they avoid downers, they don't learn, and if they don't learn, we get ourselves into worse circumstances. What happened with passive investing, as I say, I don't think it was intentional. I think what happened is there was academic research that was wonderful. It was a big advance. And that academic research took us from an understanding of stocks where we thought of stock investing as risky. That was the earlier understanding. And we're on our way to a much better understanding, a much better place, where instead of just saying stocks are risky and money markets are not risky, that's sort of a it's sort of a juvenile way to think about investing. It's true, but it's just too basic. It's primary colors and nothing else. It's cartoonish. Either stocks are risky, money markets, burying it in the yard is not risky. I think we're going to end up at a place where we practice probability / rational investing, calculating risk. That's what we should be spending all of our energies on. All the experts should be working on books to tell us how do we manage risk. Oh, John Walter Russell had this comment at an entry at his website recently. He said, I may not have it exactly right, but I think he said, manage risk, don't avoid it. I thought that was great. That hits it on the head. You don't want to avoid risk. You want to manage risk. That's the ticket. And that's where I think we're headed. So the old model was, if you're risk averse, avoid stocks, avoid risk. We're heading to a place where the idea is not to avoid risk, but to manage risk. But the passive investing error is this unfortunate error sandwiched in between where the idea was ignore risk. Don't be risk averse. Put all your money in stocks. But don't calculate it. Never think about how much risk you're taking on. Never dare to look at the historical data in an analytically valid way. Go into it blindly. Take on huge amounts of risk, but make sure you cover your hands with your eyes. Put your fingers in your ears. Make sure you don't know what you're doing. So you're taking on the risk without knowing it. And that's the worst of all worlds. So we sort of went from this not such a great place, not such a bad place, to a horrible, terrible, if you had some mad scientist and you gave him the assignment of coming up with the worst way to invest imaginable, he would have came up with passive investing. That's my take on it. That's how strongly I feel. Passive investing is wrong on the numbers. So in a substantive way, it's a bad idea. But it's even more wrong in the way it hits us emotionally. It emotionally prepares us to always do the wrong thing. It emotionally influences us to always do the wrong thing. To buy when we should sell and to sell when we should buy. And to not calculate risk. And I think the only way to invest effectively, passive investing does say to be a long-term investor, and I applaud that element of it, but it doesn't at all lay the groundwork for what you need to do to be a long-term investor. What you need to do to be a long-term investor is to gain confidence in your strategies. And that comes from calculating risk. When you know what's coming, you can handle it. Sort of like, my boys, they're older now, but when they were younger, now I read them Lord of the Rings, but I, once upon a time, I used to read them George. George, is that the name of the monkey? Curious George. And of course, you notice that they come out with these, I had complete Curious George, and they had one Curious George goes to the hospital. And obviously, the whole idea of the book was, if a kid finds out he's going to have to go to the hospital, you would buy him this book to sort of prepare him. And it shows George going into the hospital. Of course, it makes you laugh. You know, you look at the funny pictures, and you hope that your kid now, he won't be so scared about going into the hospital. He'll have seen everything before he goes there. He'll have seen a stethoscope, you know. He'll have seen what doctors look like, how they're dressed, you know, and their uniforms, so that you have an idea. It won't frighten you when you see it. When the nurse tries to take your temperature, you won't be freaked out. You know, you'll have expected that. In other words, train people to get over their fears by letting them know what's coming. That's what we should be doing with stock investing. Let people know. When people invest at insanely high valuations, let them know, look, you're free to do that, but you're going to be suffering a huge loss. There's going to be some big price crashes coming up ahead. Let them know in advance, and they'll be able to, you know, if they choose to do it, they choose to do it, but at least they'll be able to deal with it. They won't freak out. But telling people to take on this, you know, this huge amount of risk and not letting them know that they're going to lose their retirement money, that was truly dangerous, irresponsible advice. And I hope that that's a temporary thing. I hope that the passive investing model was sort of an in-between place. And we're heading to a model where we calculate risk. And this is what I would like to see all of the experts and, you know, all the people on our discussion boards talking about. How can I manage risk? Not avoid it. I don't want to avoid it. I'm not a scaredy cat. I know you need to invest in stocks to accumulate enough money to finance a middle-class retirement. But how can I do it in a responsible way? How can I do it in a way so that I'm taking on risk, but I'm taking on reasonable amounts of risk. I'm calculating risk in advance. And the way you do that is by avoiding passive investing at all costs. You never want to be passive. Passive means don't change your stock allocation. Well, the way you manage risk is by changing your stock allocation in response to price changes. So what passive is saying is don't do that. Don't manage risk. Don't calculate risk. It's exactly the wrong message. Now, the really exciting thing is that in the work that we've been doing in the Retire Early and Indexing discussion boards over the past 7 years, you know, we're in the preliminary stages. I don't say we have all the answers, but we've come up with a lot of exciting stuff. And one of the things we've come up with is that we can reduce risk dramatically. I mean, far more than I ever would have thought possible. And I'll just give one quick example of this. At 20 years out, there are statistical tools you can use to determine how predictable something is. And the stock return predictor at my website and at John Walter Russell's website, John's site is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. The stock return predictor is at both sites. We developed the calculator together. John did the statistical work. It tells you what the most likely return is at 10 years out and 20 years out, 30 years out for the S&P. And it tells you the range of possibilities, and it assigns probabilities to various points on the range of possibilities. And, returns, we don't make predictions for time periods less than 10 years because we can't. The returns are not sufficiently predictable until you go 10 years out to make statistically meaningful predictions. At 10 years out, we can make statistically meaningful predictions, but the range is pretty broad. You know, you can get a good idea what the return's likely to be, but not too precise. At 15 years, you can be a lot more precise, and at 20 years, you can be incredibly precise. At 20 years, the predictability of stock returns is 78%. 78% is knowable. Just knowing the P/10 value at the beginning, at when the stock purchase is made. Only 22% is unknown. So I think a good way of defining risk is what is known. You know, instead of saying risk is volatility, risk is what is unknown. So if you go that way, you know, if you use that definition, the passive investing model says stock returns are totally unknowable. You know, the passive approach says don't change your allocation. So the implication is nothing is known. You can never know that today is a better day to invest in stocks than yesterday or tomorrow, because they're all the same. To the passive investor, they're all the same. So essentially what they're saying is it's all unknown. It's all just a gamble. It's all just a guess. So you have 100% unknowability, randomness. With rational investing, you've got 22% randomness, 78% knowability. So 22% randomness versus 100% randomness, what that tells us is the passive model is almost five times as risky as the rational model. Now, there are different ways you could think about it. And depending on how you think about it, you might come to, you might say, oh, it's only four times or it's only three times or whatever. But I don't see how anyone can argue that you greatly diminish the risk of stock investing by looking at the historical data, looking at a calculator like the stock return predictor, and setting your stock allocation in accord with what the most likely possibilities are. You greatly increase your returns. You certainly can show that. You know, play with the calculator and you'll see, or you'll do even better if you play with the scenario surfer. Choose some stock allocations and see what works, and you'll see that valuation-informed indexing yields much, much greater returns. But it also yields those returns at much reduced risk. That's the beauty of it. Because with the passive investing people, again, they're always saying you can't do any better. You know, you're helpless. There was a guy, Chin Whiskers, used to say, I'm a know-nothing investor. That's passive investing. Passive investing is a know-nothing approach. It's a deliberate, willful effort not to learn, to be uninformed. And this is what I most dislike about the passive investing model. It's not just that it gets things wrong, not just that it's dangerous, but that it encourages investors not to know. And I think the key is to know what you can. You know, obviously there's many things we can't know, and that's life. Nothing we can do about it. But I regret that we don't know more. You know, I wish we could get the 20-year number, to be 98% predictable instead of 78. And I wish that we could get the 10-year number to be 78% predictable. And I wish we could get the 5-year number to be 60% predictable. I wish, but we can't. At least we can't now. We don't have the tools today. We can't do it today. But I wish, I sure don't wish that things were less predictable. But the know-nothing investor, the passive investor, he wants things to be unknown. He doesn't want to know. That's what you're saying. When you make a statement, I will just stick with the same stock allocation regardless of how high the risk is, regardless of how low the return is, you're making a statement to yourself and to others that you don't want to know. That's what passive investing is all about. And that's why it's maddening to me, because I just like to know stuff. That's why I'm a journalist to begin with. I'm a knower, a seeker of knowledge. So I think risk is not knowing, but the worst risk of all is deliberately not knowing, because then you truly are handicapped. You can't know. It's not just that you don't know, you can't know. And that's where we are today. We're in the strange twilight zone where we've taken the tools that were frankly developed by a lot of the people who today advocate passive investing. These are the people who started development of these tools. And then they jumped to some hasty conclusions and they got on the wrong track. And now we have picked up these tools in the retire early and indexing communities over the past 7 years. And we didn't go on that wrong path. We took a different turn. And we said, let's use these tools to know more, to know the probabilities, and to think through strategies where we invest in accord with the probabilities, and thereby to reduce risk. Does it mean that rational investors will take on less risk? Yes and no. It means that we will take on less risk, in that we invest in a way that is so much less risky that, yes, obviously, we're going to have less risk than passive investors. But as we gain confidence, which is what happens when you know more, when you have a better sense of what's going to happen, we're willing to take on more risk. So maybe in a total sense, our money is not as much at risk, but we're less afraid of stocks. So we end up actually, in many cases, we end up with higher stock allocations. You know, one of the wonderful things that I've discovered using the Scenario Surfer is that I, of course, lower my stock allocation. When prices are high, I lower my stock allocation when I'm using the Surfer. And so I avoid the effect of price crashes to a large extent. But then when prices get low, I feel pretty good about, I say, hey, I haven't suffered a price crash. You know, I'm not down. I'm not depressed. I'm not fearful. And I up my allocation at times of low prices. So I take on much higher stock allocations than passive investors would dream of taking on. At times when the long-term value proposition is very good, that's when you make all your money in stocks. You see? The returns from stocks are not steady and smooth. What happens is there are time periods like today, or like the last 16 months, when you're going to lose money that you've been, you're going to lose years of savings, decades possibly. You'll fall behind by years or by decades. And there are other time periods when you'll just zoom ahead. And the passive investor makes no effort to distinguish. He just says, I can't know. I'll just take a chance. The rational investor, by lowering his risk at times when risk is extremely high, he positions himself to take on more risk when risk is low. And he overcomes his natural risk aversion to some extent, not totally, to be sure. But he overcomes his natural risk aversion by learning how stock investing works, and thereby by becoming more confident in his choices. So he ends up with far higher returns in the long run while taking on far less risk. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.